Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Now, Ruth Ann Cunningham is in studio. She's a songwriter behind some of the biggest hits that you know of the last 20 years, and her songs have billions of streams and views. And after writing for others, she's writing her own songs in the last couple of years, talking about finding her voice and on tips on what you can do as well is the Dublin woman herself, Ruth Ann Cunningham.
Hi, thank you Welcome. So much for having me, Oliver.
God, I'm looking at this book and there's loads of fancy photographs of you with very famous people. There you are with Hozier, which is a lovely thing. And I think that's Quincy Jones,
and Stevie Wonder.
Jimmy Kimmel?
Yeah, I was on the Jimmy Kimmel show a few years ago, yeah.
John Legend is there. I mean, there's like lots of big names. What was Jimmy Kimmel like? Did you get
so lovely. Yeah, the loveliest guy. Yeah, really, really lovely.
Very, very world famous there for a week or two.
I know, he has, but he's amazing. And I'm so glad he's back on the air.
Oh my God, you've had an amazing life. Let's get into it. A new album and a new book.
So yes.
You just like to put everything out and...
Yeah, I got pregnant with my second baby and I thought, listen, this is the perfect time to write a book, make an album. And then I forgot, oh, and then the baby's going to arrive. And now here I am with you.
Oh, I don't even know much about the baby, should I ask?
No. Okay. We'll focus on the book and the album for today. That's a whole nother show.
Would this book have helped you when you were starting out in this mad
industry?
Absolutely.
That's why I wrote it, because it's the book I wish I had. Because I was 17 when I wrote my first hit. And a lot of people in the industry, they have their hits older because it takes, you know, a few years to. So I kind of did it the opposite way, and I could have used a book like this to help me navigate the music industry, definitely.
When you're 17, were you still at home? Had you just left?
Yeah, so I was brought over by an Irish manager to LA, and that's where I met Billy Steinberg and wrote Too Little Too Late for Jojo, and that was what got my foot in the door. So I was going back and forth to LA, then I moved there for some time. Yeah, so I kind of went for it at 17. My parents were very supportive.
And your parents were back home where?
In Ireland, in Donaghmeet.
In Donaghmeet, that's where Donaghmeet, you grew up.
Donaghmeet, Dublin 13, yeah. Northsider.
Must have been a big musical household.
Oh, it was. Mum and Dad were always. My dad was air guitar into Cream when I was fiddling it when I was younger. And my mum loved a bit of Garth Brooks, The Dance, like Thunder Rolls.
Quite a mix going on in the house.
Yeah, and a bit of Aretha Franklin and a bit of James Taylor. So my musical influences are all kind of a mesh of all that.
And how did you know as a kid this is what you wanted to do?
I just remember being obsessed with music. That's what I talk about in the book. I just was obsessed with music. I was already doing those 10,000 hours before I could even talk. I was just obsessed with it from a very young age.
And you were so young, and this is going to LA in noughties period, I presume.
No, it was the start of the millennium.
It was the start of the millennium.
Yeah.
That's not the noughties.
I don't know.
The 2000s.
The 2000s. So The 2000s. I'm not that old.
What was LA like in those days?
It was very, it was a lot. It was Hollywood. It's a 17-year-old who hadn't really been out of Ireland, to be honest, which from a middle-class, working-class background, just thrust into Hollywood. So it was everything you can imagine. It was a lot of celebrity, fame, money, you know, excess, everything like that. But I always just kept my head down and kept it about the music, to be honest with you. I was always just very wanting to make music. That was what I always led with, was like talent first, everything else.
I always wonder when you're trying to make it in a place like that, because it always seems to be parties, lunches, meetings. How do you actually get the work done?
Oh, I'm a studio person. So for me, it's like I obviously had to do a bit of the networking. You always have to do a bit of networking.
Right.
And I talk about that in the book as well. You have to build your community and be around people and network and do that. But I was very much all about wanting to make music and keep it about the songwriting, because that's what will propel your career forward, is the songs. Like, there's only so much talking you can do before you need to play, and you need to be in them rooms and deliver. So for me, it was like I just always tried to find collaborators that I could make great music with, and that's what I've always stuck to.
You had a hell of a chaperone as well at a young age going out there. That was the manager of the Script?
Yes. Yeah. The manager of Mark and Danny. Yeah, they mentored me. They kind of taught me how to co-write and how to, get my first foundations in the music industry. So, very thankful to all of them for that.
When we look at your career now, we kind of go, the JoJo song you mentioned, Too Little Too Late, which we know really well here. I'd say half the people listening to it have no idea there's such an Irish connection to it.
Yeah.
Were there lots of other kind of half hits in the run up to that, or is this a big wallop that lands you?
No, I had kind of one in Australia the first, but then the JoJo one was really my kind of like, it was like the biggest global it was the biggest break I could have ever hoped and dreamed for. I never would have thought. So yeah, it was a big break. And now that song still, I mean, it's almost 20 years old and it still is so massive all over TikTok and people just know that song forever. And the same like Niall Horan songs I've done and the Britney, the work B-I-T-C-H song I've done. And but I do find it mad that people don't always know or believe that I was a part of them. So if I'm in a gym or something and it's playing, or if my friends say to someone, oh, she wrote that, that people will be like, no, she didn't. And I kind of love that because I'm like, yeah, whatever. Yeah, I'm like, whatever, it's fine. I don't mind.
This is Jojo. What year is this?
Jojo Too Late was 2004 when we wrote it, in 2006 when it came out.
Oh, it's such a sound of that era.
Yeah.
Singing along still.
Singing along. Yeah. It's a tune. It is a tune.
I love that you're so proud of your work. It's like, that's an un-Irish thing.
No,
that
we do you know
can, you
what?
Can be confident.
No, don't worry. It's not that. It's that I'm more just like, I can't believe sometimes when I listen back to stuff that I got to be a part of that. It's more like just being, yeah, just feeling really grateful that I got to do that.
How big was that song in America at the time?
It was very big. It broke history at the time. It jumped from number 63 in the Billboard to number 2, right beneath Justin Timberlake.
Go away.
Yeah, and T.I. And like, so it was massive. And
number 2 hit in America.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was number 1 in pop because there's all different charts there. So it broke records there at the time and it just went nuts. And then I feel like over time it's even become like even more bigger.
That would still be earning for you, wouldn't it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, anytime.
And you were very young. This was huge success.
Yeah.
And the money came.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then it went as fast as it came.
Were you
Oliver.
Equipped? You weren't equipped, obviously.
I was
for the,
not
for
equipped.
The loot.
And my parents are very good because it's not like they were saying, oh, we'll control the money. Like at the time when it came out, I was 19, I was 20. So I did some smart investing and then I did some very dumb. My friends were all in college. So I was like, yeah, I'll take it to Egypt. Yeah, sure. Well, I'll get
to
a car.
Egypt.
Yeah, I would say, I put 3 of my best friends to Egypt on a 5-star. And I was just like, all my friends couldn't afford to do things.
Yeah.
I know. So I'd be like, I'll pay for it, whatever. So I was very generous, too generous, I think. And with boyfriends, Oliver, you know how it goes. You'd be paying for all the boyfriend stuff. And then the boy.
Jesus.
So anyway, and then they break my heart. But yeah, no, I lost the money then. So then I had to have more hits. So this is the thing. You can't just have one hit. You have to keep going. So that's
Did
why
you?
Over the 20 years, I've had to keep going and having more hits because the money doesn't last.
The money from Too Little Too Late. When did it just go one day? Did you wake up one day it was gone or did it suddenly?
No, it just over the years. You think as a 19-year-old, you naively think, oh, this money is going to last forever.
Yeah, and then
you don't realise you're spending it. And then the thing was, I went over to LA and LA is very expensive. So it was just like, and I didn't have parents. So it was like, I would ring my mum and say, oh, I think I'm now going to give up. And she'd say, well, you'll be on the boat. Mum, will you be on the boat home? There's no, we won't be able to. So I just thought, okay, do you know what? I'm going to work so hard. So I just grafted. I worked incredibly hard and just had more, very luckily had more hits and more success, and I'm still here, you know, 20 years later, and wrote a book about it and have a new album. So I'm just always doing it.
What was the next big thing then that picked yourself up after?
I had an Avicii song out and then I had the Britney Spears song.
Oh yes, we have a clean version of this.
Oh, the work.
I thought we were grown up enough to say the work. We'll give a little warning and we'll play the clean version.
You want a hot body? You want a boot body? You want a Maserati? You better
work. Yeah.
You got a work, bitch.
Yeah. Oh, did you just say it?
I mean, I think we're all grown-ups here. I mean, we're not afraid of the work.
Yeah.
You mean a female dog, don't you? Yeah, that's got a work, bitch.
No, I love that one. Yeah. So that.
Are you doing lyrics on this one, or what are you doing?
Yeah, lyrics and melody. Yeah. Will I Am. Credit to him.
I'm enjoying the.
The work B-T-I-C-H. The work B-T-I-C-H. That's Will I Am's genius. But yeah, mad to just be part of that song. And she performed at her Vegas show. All the merch was that song merch.
So you were in contact with Will I Am.
Yes, Will I Am. Yeah. Yeah. And
I think the work bitch phrase came from who? It was some kind of meme or something.
Oh, I don't know. But I just know that will.i.am was the one who wanted to put it in, do a song about it for Britney, because I think it was perfect and it was a big comeback moment for her. I just remember getting a call one day from the guy I'd written with, Anthony, who worked with will.i.am, and was like, oh, do you remember that song we worked on? Well, you know, I want to play you who's singing it. Played me Britney Spears. I said, is that Britney, bitch? He's like, it's Britney. And so he goes, it's coming out in 4 days. Oh, and I, and God, then she tweeted it, and my, she tweeted the lyrics of my name, and I was like, my phone started blowing up. So that was kind of the next big one.
Yeah.
Then I had In the Name of Love, Martin Garrix, Bebe Rexha, Niall Horan. I did like
that's
five.
That's a huge on one, by the way. That you were skipping over.
Oh, sorry.
Well, like, I think that's got a billion views almost
billion
on YouTube, just on YouTube,
just Spotify. Yeah.
And YouTube as well.
And YouTube.
You already know. Yeah.
I don't know.
Huge dance tracks. Those ones are.
Yeah, huge dance track. That was. I'm a bit of a greedy creative. I like to write in all different genres. Yeah. So I think that. That's what I love about music, is just you get to write it. So then with Niall and One Direction, I did some with One Direction, and then with Niall I did like five on his first album Flicker, including like So Hands and Seeing Blind and all that stuff. And then in the second record I did Nice to Meet You and San Francisco, and then I did
These
Alibi.
Are the tunes we all know.
Good. I did Alibi with Ella Henderson last year. I'd done stuff with John Legend and Diana Ross, but yeah.
When you're doing songs for John Legend, Diana Ross, do you get to meet them?
Yes, I worked with John. I've worked with John a few times. He's so lovely. And when you're working with John Legend, it's like getting a mini concert, because he's on the piano.
Yeah.
And you're going in. And obviously, I was such a massive fan of John, so I was quite nervous going in when I first worked. And it was just him and me. And he kind of looks at you, and it's like you get your own concert. You get your own John Legend concert. He's singing to you, and you're like, oh God, this is a John Legend concert. He doesn't even need me here, but I'm here anyway. And yeah, he's amazing and such a lovely guy. I'm just very fortunate.
Not good on small talk. It's like, hi John, how are you? And it's just piano.
Oh, he is. Okay. He's straight in.
And
he's
just
like,
watch.
Yeah, he is. He's amazing. He's
how's the missus? No, okay. I'll listen to the music.
No, well, we chatted a bit, because when you're writing songs with people, you have to get the story. So we had some nice chats and got to write about, it was a Christmas song for his Christmas record, about his Christmases at home and stuff like that. So so it was a great experience. And then I've gotten to do amazing things. I hope
Diana Ross was the nightmare diva that would be promised.
No, I didn't get to write with her. So sometimes you write with the artist, sometimes you write without the artist. So I didn't get to write with her, but she...
Did not come out and say at some point, thanks for writing the song that made me
She
look
actually,
good.
Actually, do you know what? She did. She thanked everyone on the record, and she did a whole post and all our names and credited us all. Right. And so that was amazing. And to be Grammy nominated with her was, you know, for that album was insane. So... Yeah, another one that was like not on my bucket, like would have been on my bucket list, but didn't seem realistic. And then it happened, which is mad.
It's extraordinary. But you kind of lived out the lyrics to Britney Spears, if you wanted it, the Maserati and this and that. You've got to work.
I don't have a Bugatti, Oliver. I don't have a Maserati. The songwriters
metaphors,
don't get...
Metaphors. You've got to pay the rent. You've got to work.
Exactly. The metaphor is there. And I definitely took that on in my life and worked very hard. And I'm still working.
After some of the hits, and when you were struggling, you did have to, you know, go out and just play music yourself. I think, did you not? Were you in a wedding band at one point? Or
yeah, I was. I lost all the money, I would walk into sessions, people still would say I was a hit songwriter, but I was in wedding bands on the weekend. And that's where I kind of thought to myself, I need a song in a wedding, because I was seeing all the biggest songs in the world always being played at these weddings. And it was amazing, actually, because then I wrote my song, The Vow, which has gone on. Because
people who work in wedding bands, they're the happiest people I know.
Yeah, because like, it's so fun.
It's a great job.
It's a great job. I loved it.
Out of that came The Vow.
Out of that came The Vow. Like, I didn't think about it, but in my head at the time, I said, oh, I need a song in weddings. And then about 5 years later, when I was back, you know, doing it and doing my first album, I wrote The Vow, not thinking about a wedding. I was heartbroken at the time, and I was trying to manifest my husband, and I met him 3 months later. And then the song went on to become this wedding song that I never... I didn't plan it that way, but it just happened that way. And it's been part of so many people's weddings and engagements. And it's incredible what that song has done.
How did you meet himself?
he came to one of my shows with one of my best friends and I didn't know who he was, and I saw him in the crowd and I thought, he's a bit of me. Sang straight to him, and then we're married and have two kids later, 8 years later. Yeah, like I was, you know, when you're looking at, I was, you know, I was giving it my all, thinking he's a bit of me, and then it turned out he was with my best friend, had come to see me. So I met him one of my shows, and then the vow had been written like 2 months before that, and we're married now with two children, and I feel like I manifested him through that song.
That's, did you put the vow to your videography?
Really, I think I did. And we had a gospel choir. We had the Dublin Gospel Choir sing the vow, my own song at the wedding. Only because everyone was like, "Well, you have to have the vow at your wedding." So we did. But yeah, it was a lovely moment. Yeah.
But all of this work that you've done, you were writing for hits for other people. You didn't do your own. You weren't your own star, your own artist on stage yourself, were you? Yeah. What held you back?
I think in the industry, you know, it's a very hard industry. And definitely when I was younger, people said, oh, you're not hot enough to be J-Lo or Beyonce, and you're not quirky enough to be Beth Ditto. Or so you're just kind of somewhere in the middle, and that's not sellable. You're not marketable. All the usuals
that
they tell you.
Was that a vibe, or was that literally told to you?
That was literally told to my face by many people.
You're not hot enough to be a pop star.
Yeah, you're not hot enough to be a pop star. You're not skinny enough. And when I tell you, I was skinny back then. Like, this was when I was skinny. And I was still too fat, apparently, to be. Anyway, regardless, it did hold me back. But the one thing that kept me coming back to being an artist, and why I did release The Vow and whenever, because I had a story to tell. And I think that nobody should ever tell someone who they are or who they aren't. Mm-hmm. And nobody should put limitations on what you can do. So for me, when I wrote The Vow, it was like, no one's going to sing this because it's my story and it's a ballad. And so I released it. And now I'm so fortunate that I've get to release music and have my own listeners and my own followers, and that's the thing. There's no rules anymore. There's no gatekeepers in the music industry. If you want to be an artist, you can upload your music on SoundCloud, Spotify, any of the places, and you can become. And it's not about being a star. It's not about fame. It's not about being a pop star. I'm trying to be Carole King. I've got two kids. I'm a mom. I'm doing mom music. You know, I'm trying to do the emotional love song ballads. Like, my mom was listening to Garth Brooks and Carole King. That's who I feel like what my music is for, is for those emotional people who want to just listen to a classic love song. I'm not cool, Oliver. I'm just emotional.
You're very cool. This is a rallying cry for anyone out there who has any talent. Go and do it.
Go and do it. There's
I'm leaving to follow
you.
My dream.
Yeah.
Finish the interview.
Sure, if you read my book, you'll be able to write a hit song in no time.
That's the whole thing, isn't
it? Yes.
So they told you that they were wrong because you have the following. You're an amazing performer. Tell people about your success as a performer on stage, who you've been out and about touring with.
Oh, God. Oh, well, I feel like it's a big name drop session, but I'm lucky enough that I got to open for Hozier, fellow Irishman, one of our biggest exports. Alanis Morissette, I've got to tour with. Oh, I've sang on stage with Niall Horan and ex-ambassadors. And yeah, I've been just really lucky to have gotten to perform my own music for people and to be able to have that outlet creatively as well. And I have a new album coming out on Friday, actually, this Friday, on vinyl. Go get the vinyl and the CD. And I'm doing a headline show in the Sugar Club to celebrate a little album launch on October 15th, so you can get tickets and come see me sing.
That is next week, isn't it?
That is next week, yeah.
Wednesday week.
Yeah.
In the Sugar Club.
And my book, I'll be in Golden Discs as well in Cork on Saturday. I'm going to do a little acoustic performance down in Cork.
I love that still happens.
I think it's brilliant. I love it. Like,
the vinyl has kept Golden Discs and all the merch.
Yeah, and I tell you what, for artists, like, it's amazing to have a physical copy of your own work. Yeah. And I used to love, when I was younger, opening the CD booklets, looking at the credits. So I feel like bringing that back now, I think we love listening to music online, but go get the physical copies, because that's what keeps us being able to feed our children, to be honest with you. So come to Golden Discs. I'll be singing The Vow and a few other of the new songs there.
You've hit
on
the
Saturday
thing, which is obviously going to be addressed in the book, which is the whole thing about artist taxes and this difficulty of artists, that they get billions of streams, everyone's listening to you, and you're not making anything out of it. Explain it.
Yeah, there's a bad pay gap in the industry that was decided by the labels and the streaming companies when streaming came into play. And it basically means that if you get a million streams, the songwriters get £400. The label and the master owner get £4,000. This is approximate numbers, but this is around the number. So £400 to split them between. So say if you and I write a song with two of your mates in there, that's, we get £100 each for a million streams. Mm-hmm. So, but the record label and the master owners get £4,000, and that usually goes to, you know, so it's less people to split it. So the pay gap is astounding.
Massive.
And you have, it means that a million streams is nowhere
near gonna.
The
streamer is
obviously
making loads of money.
Yeah, the master side of the streaming is making a lot of money, but
that's the
songwriting side is not making the money. The songwriters are not making it. The labels are making it.
Okay.
So we're trying to work hard to, you know, bridge that gap and make
it
a fairer,
people write
more
off,
equal.
Doesn't it? I mean, what? How do you address this for someone? How do you give them hope? Thinking, well, sure, even if I go massively viral, I won't make any money out of it.
I think it's about understanding that if you're in music, you're not in it to make money. As in, obviously, you need to
make a living.
You need to make a living. But it's hard out there. And that's why you need my book, Oliver. That's the best advice I can give you. My book is how to sustain a career. I've been in it for 20 years. And it's how to make a long-lasting, long-term career in music, whether you're a songwriter, artist, producer, label, management, anything. In my book, I give you all the tips. And it's not just my tips. I interviewed the biggest and best songwriters in the world right now, currently up to date, of how they are sustaining their careers and how they are making their careers.
And these are people who've worked with Selena Gomez, everyone, right?
Oh, Sabrina Carpenter, Teddy Swims, all the people that are having the biggest success right now as songwriters and how they did it. And it's really going to help inspire people, but also teach them how to navigate the music industry, because it is a very difficult industry to navigate. It's the Wild Wild West.
What about the artists, the big names who also take writing credits in a song where they haven't contributed anything?
Yeah, that's what we call kind of artist taxes. I mean, look.
That's the artist taxes.
Yeah, yes. There are songs that I've been a part of that I've written 5% of. The songs that I've been a part of that I've written 90% of. It's hard to you know, put a price on the value on that. The song wouldn't be the same if the person wasn't in the room. Now, where there is issues sometimes is the artists sometimes aren't in the room. So for me, it's like, if we're in the room, anything that I say can contribute to the song, anything that anyone does. But when the artists aren't there, I do have a problem with the artists taking publishing.
There's no way they're involved.
They haven't been there. But, and it used to be a thing back in the day when I first started, but it's become a big thing now. So it's making it even more harder for songwriters to make a living, because they're having to split their pie even more with people who weren't involved in the song.
They're not in the room where it happened.
Yes, exactly. So that's something that we need to address as well.
So this is the second album, which is you and all of your work and you performing. You're still writing for other performers too?
Yes, always writing for the people. Yeah.
Can you tell us who you're working with at the moment? Are you NDA'd up to the eyes?
Well, sometimes I have to keep some things under wraps, but I have been working with Paloma Faith recently on her new record, and she's amazing, and I'm excited for people to hear it. And Clementine Douglas is an artist who featured on the new Calvin Harris song. She's amazing. We did the Sonny Federa song together, and she's a one to watch. And I'm also developing new talent. There's a new Irish artist called Sinead Ashokai. She is absolutely, like, hear that name now, she is going to be massive.
Okay.
She's like an Adele. She's like Adele meets Amy Winehouse meets Jeff Buckley. She's going to be huge. So I'm
give us the tunes. We'll spin them when the time comes.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, you can spin mine first.
We will. That's out
right
on Friday.
Now,
Friday. It's called The Moment. Tell us what's happening in this album.
This album is really, you know, for people who know The Vow and know Safe Place and some of my other music, it's really, I really wanted to make an album of moments. For more moments for people to sound my music to soundtrack of their lives, because the videos that I've seen online really just always make me so happy. And it's really an album about moments in it that everyone goes through as human beings, and it's love, loss, joy, celebration,
good
grief. And it's really harkened back to, like I said, the Carole King Tapestry type albums, where it's really just classic songs in a classic way. It's soulful singer-songwriter, it's Fleetwood Mac, it's all my favourites put in one record of all the moments that I've had. And I'm hoping that it can soundtrack more people's moments.
And you're releasing this independently?
Yeah, my own label, Manah Music. My own label, but it's through a distributor. So I have a distributor. I have an amazing team.
Because you know how the system works. That's what
the
book is all about.
Yeah, I do. And I think that I think these days being empowered and, you know, the knowledge and being able to get to put your own teams around it. I have amazing teams around me. Why would you not do it yourself? So, I'm an independent artist proudly, and I'm just very grateful to anyone who supports my music and buys the music and comes to the shows.
You're an incredible hard worker. How are you managing all of this? Is your Like, is your husband involved in the business? Or like, is
yeah,
everyone?
He's a songwriter too. The two of us are in the same.
It's the only way that could work.
It would be great if one of us had a more stable job. But this is the thing: you can't help who you fall in love with. I'm sure at times he's gone, I wish that you just worked in finance, and I wish that. But you know what? We love it. We write together. He's written one of the songs on my album. He's doing amazing. He's just had a hit song, his first hit song as a songwriter. So I'm very proud of him. We have two little girls. We have a village that helps us. If anyone has listened to me thinking that I've got doing it all, no. Yeah. I'm doing the best that I can as a working mom. I do everything for my girls. We have a village that helps us, and we're just trying our best every day to put our best foot forward and do things that we want to do and inspire people to do the same.
You're a very inspiring person.
Oh, thank you.
Something dark the book goes into is this problem in the music industry. Mm-hmm. And I suppose we give a small warning here because it's an unpleasant story. It's something happened to you in Nashville. How long ago was this?
8 years ago. Yeah. And I was 39 years ago.
Did you feel safe in the industry at that point?
I did. I knew it went on. I knew that, you know, certain misogynistic cultures, I definitely had to navigate the boys club, as I call it. But it was the first time I experienced, yes, a man that wouldn't take no. And that was very terrifying at a writing camp. A very terrifying experience and something that, you know, I'm still healing from. And I've had therapy and I told everyone, you know, I got safe. I was taken care of. But he's still working in the industry today. And this was at a time, remember, Me Too had not happened yet when this happened. I was at an A-list writing camp. The label were told what had happened to me. I told my management, my publisher, you know, they were told. And the label head said, thank you for letting us know. And then nothing was done.
Never heard again.
And he won a Grammy a few years ago for an album. So it's, you know, I told everyone I need to tell. I still tell everyone who it is in the industry. I'm not interested at the moment of going on Twitter and making it a court of public opinion for my own healing and my own. I mean, I don't need the court of public opinion to tell me.
That would set things off.
Yeah. For me, it's like sometimes with sexual assault, you're wondering if the person even knows what they did was criminal. That's the scary thing about some men these days. Do they know that their actions were criminal if it wasn't rape? And that's where women struggle as well, because when it happened to me, my first thought was, oh, I wasn't raped. So what do I do? Do you know what I mean? But it was sexual assault.
Yes, of course.
And so it's very difficult to come to terms with that. He was completely intoxicated. He was just out of his face. And you know, what he did was very wrong and it was criminal. But at the time, there was nothing to protect people in the industry, in the music industry then, because the Me Too movement hadn't happened. So me telling everyone, it was a big fear that I would lose my career, that people would be like, oh, she lied, or she's too dramatic to be in sessions with. Like, would men want to work with me again?
That was your fear.
That was my fear. Of course, would I lose my career?
He had no fear.
He had no fear. He's still working today. Now, I told the right people, because I wasn't going to stay silent on that. I told the people that needed to know, that could do something about it, which was the label heads, all my people, and nothing was done. So what does that tell you as a woman? Well, they obviously didn't believe me. But what was crazy about this was about 3 years, 4 years after it happened to me, I was in a session with other females and we got talking about this, and one girl had been sexually assaulted as well by someone different. And I didn't say his name. I started to just tell the story of what had happened. A girl turned around and says, I know who that is. He's done that to other people, and named me five other songwriters that she knew of that he'd done it to. So this is just it is improving. Since the Me Too movement, a lot of men are a lot more aware of the female experience in the studio. There's a lot of things that went on back then in the day when I first started that would definitely not go on now. And it's something that I'm, you know, still dealing with and healing from. But I'm very, in my book, I talk about a whole session safety checklist, tools to navigate the boys club. Because the boys club is in
it. To do that.
It's in every industry, though.
I'm really sorry that happened to you.
Oh, thank you very much.
But you're a powerful, powerful person to get through that.
Thank you.
And it's inside the last decade. That's what's really astonishing about it.
Yeah. What's crazy is you always think of stuff like that happening when you're younger. You know, I was very protected when I was younger, but I was 30 when it happened to me. So it's like it can happen at any age. And that's why it's so important that we protect our women and we look after our women and we, you know, get rid of this culture that exists where it's just okay and nothing said about it. And I think that, the dial is moving, and that's why I speak about it in the book, and that's why I give tools for also parents of anyone wanting to get into the music industry.
Absolutely,
also
yeah.
Men who work in the music industry or any industry, read about the female experience and then
that
you might understand more.
Yeah,
and be aware of it.
You're doing that to help people as well. And also you've been speaking and have this conversation about endometriosis.
Yes.
Which is a condition you suffered pain, went to doctors about it and we were dismissed.
God, Oliver, we need a whole other hour on this.
I know.
So endometriosis, yeah, I'm a very passionate advocate for endometriosis. I'm working with Endometriosis Ireland, Association of Ireland. I was diagnosed after 2 years of 24-hour day chronic pain. It was quite bad. It had gotten, you know, into my bowels and bladder and pelvis. But of course, doctors would tell me I was fine. I fainted. I was collapsing. I couldn't walk. I was actually touring with Hozier at the time, Alanis Morissette, and I was going straight from the robe in bed to the stage to back to bed. And everyone was telling me I was fine. Blood tests were fine.
You
scans were fine. I worked through it all. And scans were fine. Blood tests were fine. There was no indication of endometriosis other than me fighting, because I knew it was that, because I had researched and done my research, as most endo warriors out there. You know, I'm talking to you. You know more about your condition than anyone. Mm-hmm. And then I just fought. But I had to go private. I had to go to UK, pay privately. And that doctor saved my life. He did a surgery, and I had a 4-hour surgery to remove stage 4 deep infiltrating endometriosis. But I still live with it today. I have adenomyosis, which is the sister disease inside my uterus. So I'm still living with it, but I'm so grateful that I have my 2 children. I was told I would struggle to have kids, and it was. Really? We had our own journey with it, as everyone does.
How is the condition when you're pregnant? Because sometimes women are told
it goes away. Yeah,
you just go and
Because I think the body then focuses on the child, but then it comes back with a vengeance. So
what
I'm still dealing with that.
Is the solution now? Pretty dramatic.
For me and for my journey, and it's very important to say this, that it's my journey. I've had my kids now, and the only cure for my adenomyosis, there's no cure for endometriosis, very important to say that, is a hysterectomy. So I'm in the middle of you know, highly considering hysterectomy in order for me to be able to be a functioning mother for my children and be there for my children.
That's such a difficult decision, isn't it? And
it's a very difficult decision. Yeah. But for me, it's, you know, I want to get what endometriosis takes from you is your quality of life. And I want to get that back. And I think my children deserve to have a mom that can get up out of bed and be there for them. And I am doing well at the moment. Nice. But I go through periods of time where it's not so good. And so for me, hysterectomy might be what I have to do.
And let's just say as well, that's the medical advice specifically for you. People should get their own independent.
Yeah, and I'm always open
advice.
To talk to anyone, DMs. And I have an educational program with my sisters called Endo and Me, and we go to schools and talk. But it's very important. Every case of endometriosis and adenomyosis is individual. There are more complex cases. There are younger teenagers with it now, and it's very important that they take the advice of their doctors.
Remarkable. You have a remarkable story. It's been an absolute pleasure, Ruth Ann Cunningham.
Thank
the time
so
has
much.
Run away with me. But the moment is out on Friday. We'll talk about that again when it comes out.
Yeah.
And the book, It's Not Just a Song,
is out now,
Sugar Club. I'll give more details, but in the meantime, after the break, I'll come back after the break. Ruth Ann Cunningham, thank you so much.
Thank you.